upgrade your tool storage for the new year with help from Menards. For heavy-duty storage that protects your tools, choose MasterForce. From shelving units to cabinets and so much more, you can keep your tools safe and within reach. Get versatile and durable storage from MasterForce today. Check out all our MasterForce storage in-store or check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monster. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. All right.
I'll quit playing my game now for you.
Fix my Bumble blanket.
You boom. I know. I used my last night when I was trying to sleep sitting up in my chair, which was very comfortable, by the way. I used my teddy bear blanket. I know. And you picked out a good blanket.
I know. Okay, anyway. So we're back with our third episode of December.
I hit it.
Oh, okay. Which means we only have two left before we start fresh with a new year.
I wish you could stop.
I know. I know, and it's supposed to start this weekend.
I ain't going nowhere.
Me neither. Okay, so now last week we were trapped inside the walls of Cabin 28 in Keddie, California. We saw the horror that can happen in a confined space. But today, we're stepping outside. So when y'all hear this, it'll be December 15th, and winter is settling in. And to match the chill in the air, we are traveling back to 1959 to examine the mother of all outdoor mysteries.
That's before your grandma.
Yep. It was an old one.
Well, so she's grandma.
So we're going to put our imagination caps on for a minute, and then we'll get into it. So, got your cap on? Ready?
That's the raise I'm going to get.
Okay. So, I'm going to build an experience for you.
Okay.
Yeah. So first, imagine the temperature.
Freaking cold!
It is negative 25 degrees Celsius.
Oh, hell.
That is negative 13 degrees in Fahrenheit.
That's just rude.
Yeah. So it is a kind of cold that doesn't just freeze water. It freezes thought. It slows your blood. It makes every movement a calculation. The wind doesn't just blow either. It screams at speeds of 20 to 30 miles per hour, creating a wind chill that will destroy any exposed in minutes.
Not if you don't go out in.
You feel the chill yet?
I'm always cold. You know that.
So now imagine that you're in a tent.
Oh, hell no.
You're on the slope of a mountain in northern Ural of the Soviet Union.
Oh, hell no. No, wrong. No. That's just rude. Mean rude.
It is pitch black outside. You're with eight of your best friends. You're experienced and tough. You have a stove and blanket. You're safe. You feel the heavy, familiar weight of the canvas pressed against the wind. a canvas that is your only barrier between the absolute silence and the crushing cold of the night. And then something happened.
Dun, dun, dun.
Something happens that is so terrifying, so immediate, and so defined.
The bumble shows up.
And so defying of logic that you grab a knife. You don't reach for the zipper of the tent, the careful, methodical motion used to keep the elements out. You don't have time for it. You take the knife and you slash through the heavy canvas wall of the tent from the inside. You rip it open and you run.
Don't run. I'm in trouble.
You run out into the snow without your coat, without your boots. And some of you are in just your socks. And even worse, some of you are barefoot.
No.
You run a mile down the mountain, into the tree line, and into the darkness, knowing that you will likely freeze to death within hours. But whatever was in that tent, or outside of it, was worse than freezing to death. This is the story of 9 hikers, a slash tent, and a verdict that simply read, quote, "They died of a compelling natural force." This is the Diet Love Pass, the Mountain of the Dead.
No. Wrong.
I'm not wrong. That's what it's called.
You ain't gonna get my butt out there. Just the cold alone will keep me home.
Right, that's what I'm saying. No. Okay.
So there ain't enough blankets in this world to go in a tent in that kind of weather.
But they had a stove.
Nobody else would get warmth with heat from it because my butt would be all the way around it.
So this true crime story isn't just true crime or just a mystery. It's a conspiracy theory case study that is often described as a real-life whodunit or the Russian Roswell. Because of the Cold War secrecy, the military involvement, and the sheer impossibility of the forensic evidence.
No. Mother Nature's offering it meds. No.
So now before I get into it, I looked up a lot of the pronunciations. Hopefully I say them right, but I'm apologizing ahead of time if I don't. I am going.
Yeah, because she asked me, you know, I'm a butcher and maybe word.
Right. So I'm going to primarily use first names, except for one of our victims, which I'll explain why I'll be using his last name in a minute. So these names are Russian, which I do not speak. So these surnames are hard to say. So I apologize for any names that I do say incorrectly. And let's just be honest, I'm probably going to butcher them. So, but either way, please bear with me as I get through them and just know I'm doing my best to say them correctly. If any of our listeners speak Russian and can correct my pronunciation of any of the Russian names or other Russian words I say, please reach out on our socials or emails so that way I can correct those in the future. And with that, we're going to get into it. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
So to understand why this mystery has obsessed the world for 65 years, you have to understand who those people were. If you look at the photos from the trip, and I'm going to post those on our social media, they look like kids. They're smiling, playing mandolins, hugging. But do not let those smiles fool you. In 1959, in the Soviet Union, hiking wasn't just a leisure activity. It was a sport. It was patriotic, and it was rigorous. So the leader of this group was Igor Dyatlov, which is the name of the pack. It was named after him. So he was only 23 years old at the time.
Baby.
He was an engineering student at the Ural Polytech Institute. But he was also a prodigy. He was described by everyone who knew him as serious, brilliant, and incredibly physically tough. He didn't just buy gear, he built it. The stove they carried, Igor welded it. The radio he designed, which, to be specific, not the radio like exactly. But what he did is he designed and made a portable radio for his trip. He'd even made a telescope after the announcement of the Sputnik launch so that way him and his friends could watch it.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so he was brilliant. So he assembled a dream team of friends for a grade 3 hike. Grade 3 was the highest difficulty rating in the Soviet Union. At this time of year, in this location, a grade 3 hike was more like a polar expedition. That's what I'm saying. Ain't no fucking way.
Not this fat girl.
Right. Not this one either. Well, this skinny girl. Fuck you.
You can't.
Right. Mm-mm. Anyway, sorry. But Igor wasn't there alone. Okay. Like I said, he had created the dream team. He was surrounded by a crew that any mountaineer would have been jealous of. You had Zina Kolmogorova. If Igor was, it's either Igor or Igor.
It's Igor.
Well, I heard it pronounced both ways. So, sorry. So if he was the brain of the expedition, Zina was the undisputed heart of it. She was 22 years old, incredibly popular, and known as the glue that held the group together. Right. She was the one writing letters, making jokes, and keeping morale high when the wind started to fight. So I do need to note here that there was a bit of a rumored romantic history between Zina and another hiker, Yuri Doroshenko. But on this trip, it seemed as though Zina was trying to get closer to Igor.
It was probably warmer.
So it's the kind of complex dynamic that you typically find in any friend group, really. I mean, let's just be honest. So Yuri Doroshenko, at 21, was another engineering student and a physically imposing, cheerful member of the team known for his great strength and stamina on the trail. So I'm going to pause for a second before we get any further. There are two Yuris in this story. So there's the Yuri that I just told you about. Then there's Yuri Krivonishchenko, who was 23. He was also an engineering student and was considered the group's bard and poet. This Yuri was famous for his singing and his ability to quickly write witty, humorous, and sometimes poignant songs and poems about their travels. He was the author of many of the lines in the group's lighthearted journal, The Evening Otorten. Now, crucially, Yuri's background is often cited as in the conspiracy theories because he had worked at a secret nuclear facility called Chelyabinsk 40, which is now known as Mayak. So, yeah. So this connection fueled theories that he was carrying radioactive samples or that his group was somehow exposed to Soviet military experiments, particularly since his and Loudmila Dobinina, their clothes were later found to have a small amount of radiation on them. So our second Yuri was one of the two bodies found first at the cedar tree. He was stripped down to his underwear with the horrific detail of having bitten off his own knuckles in the final moments of panic and delirium.
Damn.
Yeah. And we're just getting started. So to keep these two Yuris separate, and so it's clear which one that we're talking about, I'm going to refer to the second one as his last name. So that would be Krivonishchenko. That's what we're going to call the second Yuri.
Good work.
So we don't get them mixed up. Then you had Rustam Slobodin, mechanical engineer and a devastatingly talented long-distance runner. He was the athlete of the group. He was quiet, capable, and physically relentless. Then there was Ludmila, I think that's how you say it, but I feel like that's wrong. Dobonina. I think that's how you say her name. She was the second woman on the trip. She was a strict, no-nonsense economics student. During a previous hike, she was accidentally shot in the leg by a hunter and finished the hike anyway.
Dang!
Right.
Where you go, girlfriend.
Right. This girl was tough as... So then there was Nikolai Thibaud-Brie. Yeah. So he was 23 years old. He was a construction engineer of French descent and was known as the group's chief photographer. Nikolai was one of the older, more experienced members, and many of the last haunting images from the trip came from his camera. And then you have Alexander Kolvatov. At 24, Alexander was a dedicated scientist and fellow engineering student. He was known for his calm, diligent nature and his meticulous note-taking and diary keeping, a trait that becomes tragically relevant later when we talk about a missing piece of evidence. So they're all extremely smart, athletic.
Dumb for being out there.
Right. But this is kind of, if anyone's going to do it, this is the group of people to do it.
Right. No, I get it.
But then there was the outlier, the wild part of the group. His name was Semyon Zolotaryov. Semyon didn't fit the profile of the other. While the rest of the students were in their early 20s, he was 37.
He's the old man of the bunch.
Mm-hmm. He was a veteran of the Great Patriotic War. He was a man who survived the brutal front lines of World War II while the others were still in grade. He was an enigma. He had strange tattoos on his hands and chest that family members claimed they had never seen before. Symbols and letters including Ayar, Mamu Azuaya, I believe that's how you say it. This is a phrase no one has ever been able to fully decode. He also had gold teeth, which made him very distinctive.
Gold cap? Like
that's what I'm going to assume, yeah. That's what I've seen everywhere with gold teeth, but I'm going to assume they're just caps that are gold instead of silver. Yeah. Which back then,
that was ritzy.
But yeah, the wording was different, and those were bougie, basically. You have those. And perhaps most interestingly, he was a stranger to the group. He was added to the expedition at the very last minute, transferring from another hiking group. He barely knew Igor. So I want you to keep Semyon's name in the back of your mind, because later, when we start talking about radiation, secret weapons, and a KGB cover-up, all roads lead back to the quiet veteran who joined the trip at the 11th hour. Now, originally, there were 10 hikers.
No, they didn't really know him.
No. No, he hiked with a different group. But for whatever reason, at the last minute, he transferred from that group to their group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I couldn't find why.
Maybe this group is more exciting.
Well, the other group, maybe they canceled and he really wanted to go.
Could be.
I couldn't find anything that said why it was that he changed groups.
It's only up to speculation.
Right, exactly. Which, to be honest, most of this is that.
Well, get on with it.
Well, you asked the question. So originally there were 10 hikers. The 10th was Yuri Yudin. And Yuri Yudin is the ghost that hangs over this entire story. Because he actually started the trip with them. He got on the train. He rode in the truck. He hiked to the settlement of Vizhay, the last outpost of civilization. But Yudin had chronic health issues. Sciatica and rheumatism.
Oh, bless his heart.
Which back then were not things that they really knew anything about.
Right.
So on January 28th, just as the group was about to strap on their skis and head into the true wilderness, his back gave out and he could not go on.
Oh, man.
So there's a photo of this moment, which I have, and I will show it to you. So that is this moment that I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
It'll also, of course, be on our Facebook So Yuri is hugging Vladmia goodbye, which that's her right there on the left. And Yuri is the one in the middle. So everyone is laughing. He felt like he was missing out on the adventure of a lifetime. He'd given Igor his extra wool sweater, hugged them, and turned back to leave. Yuri Udin would go on to live until 2013. For the rest of his life, he would be haunted by the question, if I had been there, could I have saved him, or would I have been the 10th body in this?
Bless his heart.
Right. Like, that survivor's guilt. Your best friend. So we know exactly what happened for the first few days because they kept diaries. They had even, like I said, produced a mock newspaper called The Evening O'Torton. Their mood was high. They were moving through the forest, following the trails of the indigenous Manzi people. The one diary entry reads, quote, "The weather is wonderful. The snow is deep. We are singing songs on the trail. It is hard work, but we are happy." Now, before we get to the final fatal night, we need to talk about the legends and the final camp they had encountered. So there's one eerie detail in that newspaper that they wrote, in a section labeled science. One of the students jokingly wrote, quote, "From recent gathering of evidence, it is clear the Yeti lives in the Northern Ural." This was a joke. But looking back, it feels like a dark foreshadowing of the monster story that would soon surround their death. Now, I mentioned the Manzi people. The Manzi people have long told tales of the mink, a large bipedal ape-like creature, the local equivalent of the Yeti. The mink is usually described as a powerful forest giant known for its ability to crush objects and remain hidden. The hiker's joke would soon fuel the worldwide legend that they were attacked by a creature of pure folklore, especially considering the crushing injuries found later. And the joke about the Yeti gets even creepier when you look at the camera films found on the site. On Nikolai's camera, the very last photo taken, frame 33, is blurry and terrifying. It shows a dark humanoid figure standing at the edge of the forest looking at the photographer. There you go.
Damn!
Okay, so skeptics say that it's just a blurry shot of a fellow hiker putting on a jacket.
There ain't nobody putting on a jacket in that picture.
I don't see that either. But, wanna, you know.
Yeah, but who are we, right?
To this day, people call it the Yeti photo. It is the last thing ever recorded on that roll of film. So up to this point, from the start
That's
of the trip. So everything so far on the trip was good, right? They were happy. They were having a good time, all of that. But on February 1st, the tone shifted. They moved out of the forest and began to climb the pass. The weather turned violent. The wind picked up and wiped out visibility. Igor realized they had drifted off course. They were aiming for a mountain called Ortotin, but the wind had pushed them westward toward a different peak. This peak was Kala Shakul. In the Manzi language, this translates to Dead Mountain.
Nice.
Now, historians will tell you that this actually means mountain without game or barren peak. But the legend has stuck. The most fantastical folklore associated with the case is the curse of Kala Shakul. Local Manzi tradition includes legends detailing the mysterious death of 9 Manzi hunters on Kala Shakul in the distant past, sometimes attributed to angry mountain spirits. I told you, this one is wild, and we're not even done yet. You don't even know what happened to them. I told you, this one
of them became human popsicle.
So the fact that the Dyatlov group held exactly 9 people who perished on this slope created a powerful modern narrative of preordained hurt, suggesting the mountain demands a toll of 9 lives. So here's the critical decision they made, okay? It's around 5 p.m. The sun is setting. The wind is howling. They are now on an exposed slope completely out in the open.
Dang.
They could have skied downhill for 1 hour and camped in the safety of the forest. But Igor says no. He decides that they're going to set camp up right there on the slope. Why, you may be asking?
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't want to lose the altitude that they had gained.
What? That could be it.
Right, because it's...
I understand that.
Right. Snow, the bad weather. It takes a long time to travel up a mountain. 1 hour.
Yeah, but they ski down that won't take them long.
No, but then it's going to take them twice as long to get back to where they are already.
Yeah, so, and I know, and I get that.
Right, so I could get that. But maybe he wanted to practice a cold camp on an incline to train for harder climbs.
Could be, could be.
So they dig a pit into the snow. They pitch the large canvas tent. They take off their wet boots and they line them up neatly to dry. Which I'm going to show you the pit that they dig, which of course this will be on Facebook also. So this is the type of pit that they dig.
Oh, okay. So it kind of blocks it.
Right.
They make like a wall.
Yeah. They kind of pack the snow in. So that way it holds it up and it also blocks the wind.
Some of the elements.
And all, yeah.
Okay.
Which I guess that's what you do when you have a cold camp. I guess that's what you do.
No, camp.
So. Yeah, I can't, but not like that. Oh, no, thank you. Anyway, sorry. So there's a detail that bothers experts when it comes to this, though. So they found the stove that Yuri had built inside the tent, but it wasn't assembled. It was still packed away. So to them, this means that Igor had definitely decided to do a cold camp. So the cold camp, there's no fire, no hot food, just dry rations and body.
No, thank you.
But this is incredibly difficult to do in negative 25 degree weather.
Yeah, think.
Or negative 15 if you use Fahrenheit. Some argue this proves that they were training for something harder. Others argue that maybe they were hiding. Maybe they didn't light a fire because they didn't want to be seen by someone or something.
Yeah.
The stovepipe was also found still packed away, which led to a niche theory that an attempt to light the stove after the initial panic without venting the smoke caused carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah.
Driving the remaining hikers into a terrified, delirious state that caused them to flee the tent but walk calmly to their death. Which I can see that, but the stove wasn't assembled, so...
That never happened.
Right, it's not possible if the stove's not put together. Like, they didn't get carbon monoxide poisoning and then take the stove back apart. How much sense is that?
They had to burn their fingers.
Right. They had also found a spare bamboo ski pole inside the tent that had been cut up with a knife. But it's... Why? Were they trying to repair the stove pipe? Were they making a splint for an injury? This one thing suggests that they were awake and awaking on, and working on some kind of problem inside the tent before the chaos starts. There's one more crucial detail about the inside of the tent. Their dinner. Investigators found pieces of ham and bacon that had been sliced but not eaten. Some pieces were found dropped on the floor as if mid-bite. So this tells us that the event was instantaneous. They were settling down, relaxed enough to eat, and then, in a split second, terror struck them.
I'm sorry, that's a waste of bacon.
Oh, God. So another contradiction to the panic narrative is that researchers found the felt inserts from the sleeping bags neatly piled outside the bag, ready to be used. So if the attack was so instant and terrifying, why would they take the time to remove the inserts from the bags and then stack them before slashing the tent wall?
Maybe they had already done it.
I mean, yeah, they could have done it like as soon as they set it up, let's get everything ready to go.
Right.
If possible. But it could also suggest an organized, albeit rapid, escape. Mm-hmm. So this is all going on. They go to sleep. And that is the last verifiable fact that we have. They were going to bed, and that's it. Everything else from this point, it's theory and speculation. So weeks go by. February 12th is the day that they were supposed to send a telegram. It comes and it goes. Their families start panicking. The university sends out search parties. The military gets involved with planes and helicopters. So it's serious.
Well, yeah.
Now, before they found the bodies, the investigators had a working theory. They were convinced this was a murder committed by the local indigenous people, the Monsi. The Monsi are expert hunters who know this terrain better than anyone else. Investigators dragged local Monsi men into their offices for interrogation. They accused them of killing the hikers for trespassing on holy ground. But there was a problem. The tent wasn't cut from the outside. It was cut from the inside. So it couldn't have been a Monsi attack. And more importantly, the Monsi told the police, quote, "We do not hunt on Kala Shakul. It is a windy, barren place. Even the reindeer do not go there."
They would know.
Right. So even the indigenous people don't go there. So this group was in a bad area. So during the search, a Monsi guide, Ivan Tatum, noticed unusual non-traditional markings carved into trees near the path. Though investigators initially saw them as potential Monsi warning signs or even signs of conflict, Tatum immediately recognized that they were crude imitations, likely carved by the students themselves as a joke or a marker, further cementing the Monsi's innocence. However, the initial theory became the root of the Monsi execution folklore, where the gruesome, silent way the final bodies died is interpreted as a unique, non-conventional form of ritualistic punishment by the offended local tribe. Yeah. So on February 26th, a student volunteer spots a small black dot on the white slope of Kala Shakul. It was the tent. It was half collapsed and covered in snow. A flashlight was found lying on top of the snow on the tent roof. It was switched off, but the battery was still working. So
it may have been there.
Right, because the tent is fresh. There's fresh snow on it, and then there's a flashlight on top of that.
Somebody had been there.
Yeah. Okay, and then as I mentioned in the intro, the investigators confirmed the tent was cut from the inside. So despite the fact that the tent was clearly slashed open with a knife, the definitive weapon used to make those cuts was never found or identified among the hunters or the hikers recovered here. So they never found the knife that cut the tent open. Mm. So this adds another layer of confusion to the thing, suggesting the knife used was either lost immediately or taken by the survivor. This lack of weapon and the bizarre calm footprints led some to the tourist killer / escape gulag prisoner myth. Proposing the group was ambushed by an external human agent, a mad trapper, or an escaped convict who used brutal, quick, silent force to dispatch them before they could cry out. I don't buy that one.
Nah.
That one seems a little too out there for me. Like, what is an escaped convict doing on top of a random snowy...
If he's smart, he's in a tropical area.
You know what I mean? Like, that. How did he get up there? This does make any sense.
Not it.
And there was one more detail found just outside the tent as well. A single spot of urine in the snow. Just one single spot.
That don't make sense.
Yep. So why does this matter? Because it implies that right before the chaos started, someone had stepped outside to relieve themselves. They were likely wearing dust socks or one felt boot. And this changes the timeline. It suggests that perhaps not everyone was asleep. Someone was outside, saw something or heard something, and that person might have been the catalyst for the panic that then took place inside the tent.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
But then they looked at the tracks, and this is crucial. There were 8 or 9 sets of footprints, but they weren't running, because you can tell by looking at footprints if someone's walking or if they're running.
Right, because walking, they're more consistent.
Right, and the gait when you're running is much farther apart.
Right.
They weren't running. The tracks showed a walking pace. Some were wearing socks, some had on only one shoe, and some were completely barefoot.
No.
So think about that. They left calmly, but in a state of undress that meant certain death. So why would you walk calmly to your death?
They were stoned.
Oh my God. So the footprints led down the slope.
Hey, you think about it.
You'll see why I say no. You'll see. We haven't got there yet. You'll see. So the footprints led down the slope toward a large cedar tree at the edge of the forest. This was about 1,500 meters away, which is the same distance as running around a standard outdoor track 3-4 times. 3 full times, and then 3/4 of a fourth left.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was under this cedar tree that the horrifying discovery began. Under the cedar tree, they found the first two bodies. Yuri and Frivonichenko. They were stripped of their underwear, and beside them were the remains of a small fire. Now, you might be asking, why were they undressed, and why run into the snow without boots? Now, there is a phenomenon which I mentioned in previous episodes, but I've just kind of touched on it. This phenomenon is called a paradoxical undressing. This happens when the human body hits the final stages of hypothermia. The nerves that control your blood vessels become exhausted and they fail. And suddenly, all the hot blood from your core rushes to your skin. So even though you're freezing to death, you feel incredibly burning hot. You feel as though you're on fire. So in your final moments of confusion, you strip off your clothes. It's a very cruel trick of the brain. And some say this is most likely what happened to the hikers at the cedar tree. But if you're hot, why would you light a fire?
Instinct.
You know what I mean?
But so, instinct.
Yeah, instinct to just have a fire because it's dark, all that. But at the same time, if you're that hot where you have to remove your clothing, why sit next to a fire? You're just going to get hotter. Yeah. A lot of questions here. So the details at the tree are haunting. The branches on the cedar tree were broken up to 5 meters high, so that's 15 feet. Skin and muscle tissue from their hands were found to be embedded in the tree bark. Right. They had frantically climbed that tree, either to get wood or to look at the tent or to escape something. Furthermore, the pieces of usable clothing, including a sweater, were found lying untouched near the fire, suggesting that the men were either too disoriented or physically incapacitated to use them for survival.
This is getting creepier.
I told you this one was going to blow your mind. So another strange detail at the cedar tree is investigators noted scorch marks running up the trunk of the tree several feet high.
The flame got too high.
This implies the small fire they built was either burning extremely hot and fast, or it was being recklessly fed large pieces of wood, suggesting panic and desperation while trying to see or keep warm. But then again, why try to climb the tree to get away from the fire? Just move.
Yeah, but people don't always think that.
That's true. Okay. But even worse, Frivonichenko had burned his own leg in the fire and didn't even seem to notice.
Well, and you're in hypothermia, yeah, it's therm.
Right. And then adrenaline, things like that. A lot of times you don't realize something's happened until you see it.
Right.
That's when
it's registered with your brain.
Yeah. So it could have just been an adrenaline thing there. But He had also bitten off his own knuckles.
See, that one I don't get.
A piece of his own skin was found in his mouth. That's how they know he did it.
No.
Yeah. So
I believe you, but no.
So was this pain delirium, or was he trying to stifle a scream?
Yeah, really? Neither one.
Right. And he just bit so hard that it bit the skin on his knuckle.
I just smacked my knuckle and bring me damn ear.
Right. Now, between the cedar tree and the tent, because obviously they now search this whole area, they find three more bodies. Igor, Dyatlov, Zina, and Rustem. They were spaced out hundreds of meters apart. And they were all positioned with their heads pointing back toward the tent. They hadn't been running away. They had died trying to crawl back up the mountain. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
It seems as though they're running away from something.
No,
but then you find the bodies, and they're facing up the mountain.
But they could have also been positioned that way.
That's true, too. Yeah. It's crazy. So the leader, Igor, was found with his hands tightly clenched and one arm bent. So if he died trying to shield his head or clench his fist against something, a posture inconsistent with the relaxed surrender of hypothermia. So this suggests a final conscious struggle. Wait, before I move on, these are going to go on Facebook, but they're kind of... So that's Igor, when they found him. There's that one. That was a little bit...
And he's facing back up the mountain.
Yep. It's so strange. So then Zina had a bruise on her side resembling a baton strike. Zina had also exhibited what the autopsy report described as a patch of bruising or discoloration on her brow, specifically on the side of her forehead, which was not deep enough to be fatal, but it suggested trauma from a localized blunt force. Perhaps
somebody smacked her in the head.
Yeah, that or she fell. Hard enough to bruise it, but not cause any major damage.
Mm.
Which how I did that the other day. So I got a bruise on my forehead right here. And there in the kitchen, totally side note, off topic. In there in the kitchen where a whiteboard is, that window that looks out, I dropped something right there and I bent down to get it from behind your soda. And when I fucking bent down, I was too close to the edge. So, you know, our window, the edges stick out.
Mm-hmm.
They're
the window
old as fuck. Yeah. And I fucking hit my head right on the corner. I didn't think I was that close to it. I just bent down the ground. And then it doesn't help that Milo was all up in my business. He's over there like, oh, look, what'd you drop?
Can I eat it?
Yeah, pretty much. It was a magnet.
I looked at that. I looked there after that.
Well, I needed it.
I understand. But you know what I'm saying.
I hit my head. I'm picking it up, okay? I didn't just hit my head for no reason. Make his shit worth it. It's kind of... I had a knot there.
I'm glad you didn't tell me this the other day because I'd have lost it. I didn't make sure you were okay. But...
Right, right. No, I was fine.
Did you see stars?
No, I didn't hit it that hard. But you know, my iron's been low. So, and I think that I had just a deep, tiny, itty bitty knot. You couldn't see it, but you could feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it bruised because where my iron's been really low lately.
It'd be nothing.
Yeah, but I was like, what the fuck? I was so mad. Anyway, back to the case. Sorry, guys. So the autopsy of Zina also noted a strong internal hemorrhage in her temporal muscle, which is a localized head trauma that doesn't fit the hypothermia-only narrative.
No, that's a smack in the head.
Yep. Hard enough to cause a major hemorrhage.
That's a big old hematoma.
Oh, yeah. Rustem had a small fracture in his skull, but ultimately, the coroner said hypothermia is what killed him. So this small fracture, coupled with Zina's bruise, leads some to the Logan's Lagove murder-suicide pact folklore. So this suggests an internal fight, possibly over Xena, erupted in the tent with one or two members forcing the others out to die in the cold after inflicting non-fatal injuries. However, there is one forensic detail with these bodies that does not fit the official story. And that's about Liver Mortis. So we've talked about Liver Mortis a few times. But if you're new, I'm going to go back into what it is. So when you die, your heart stops. And then gravity pulls your blood down to the lowest point of your body. So if you're lying on your back, the blood pools in your back. And how they can tell where the Liver Mortis is because it kind of looks like a giant bruise in that point. And that's because all of your blood has settled there. And that's what a bruise is. It's a hemorrhage under the skin. For these bodies at the cedar tree, though, the autopsies noted that the lividity spots, because that's what those spots are called,
right,
were on the front of their body, even though they were found lying on their back. So, because of this one thing, the murder-suicide pact and the fight in the tent makes no sense.
Somebody turned those bodies over.
Right. That implies they died facing down, and sometime later, someone or something flipped them over. Because as soon as you die, Liver Mortis again. Because your heart isn't pounding.
You mean rigor mortis?
No, rigor is where your body stiffens.
Yeah, I know.
So once your heart stops, the moment you die, Liver Mortis begins. Because your blood then starts to settle. Now, it doesn't all happen at once.
No, it takes time.
It takes time because you have a lot of blood in your body. But as soon as your heart stops pumping, your blood begins to settle to the lowest point.
Right.
Rigor, if I remember correctly, rigor usually takes 3 to 4 hours to start to settle in. If I remember correctly, I could be wrong on that time.
Yeah.
But I know it takes a few hours. You can look up?
Yeah.
Okay.
1 to 2 hours after death.
Okay, so I was close.
Starting in the smaller muscles like the face and the jaw, and then progresses to larger muscles over the next several hours, with the entire body usually becoming fully stiff within 12 hours.
Yeah.
The onset and duration of this postmortem rigidity are highly variable, influenced by factors such as ambient temperature, the person's physical activity before death, and their body mass.
Mm-hmm. So like me, it wouldn't take my body very long to set into rigor.
Right.
Because I'm so tiny. Whereas someone much larger than I am, it would take several hours for
like
rigor
Mike
to
and your dad.
Right. It would, because they have a lot more muscle mass than I do. It would take several hours for it to really set in. And then once you're in full rigor, that's usually at that 12-hour mark. And that's how they're able to tell when... Exactly.
Estimate time of death.
Right, because you never, it's never definitive.
Right, and they can tell when you're coming out of rigor, too.
Yeah, because once rigor sets in and you're in full rigor, your body then begins to come back out of it, which is crazy to me. It's how that happens is crazy to me. But that's how they're able to tell. Because once your body goes into rigor, even after it starts to come out of it, it's your muscles and your body is still very stiff. So that's how they're able to get that estimated time of death. Anyway.
Isn't that wild?
Sorry. Went off on a little tangent there. At least everybody learned something new. They didn't already know. Sorry, guys. But yeah, so this lividity, those lividity spots, shows that someone or something came along after rigor had set, or after Liver Mortis had set in so much that those lividity spots were visible to the eye. Because if you were to die, right, and you lay there for 5 minutes, your blood is starting to settle.
Yeah.
But then somebody comes along and they flip you over externally, you're not going to see that you died on your back. You're only going to see that internally once the autopsy is done. Externally, you won't see it until after you've been in that position for a while. So they laid there face down for quite some time before they were then flipped over onto their back.
And it was cold, so which means the blood would have moved slower.
Yep.
Moved slower.
Yep.
Sorry, I can't talk today.
So at some point, someone or something came along hours after they were dead and moved
them. Flipped
them
over like a pancake.
They may not have even died in the positions that they were found in. They could have died inside the tent for all we know. It's crazy, isn't it? So the purpose of it is, why move the body? And who did it? A final note on the initial bodies, Yuri Doroshenko was described in the autopsy as having a ground purple complexion with grayish foam coming from his mouth. This unique detail has been used to argue for a chemical, or poison exposure, a lesser known variant of the human experiment theory. So, that's five bodies they have found so far.
Okay, and there was eight total?
There were nine total, so we're missing four. So the search continued. But it was not until May, 3 months later, when all of that snow began to melt, when they would find those remaining four bodies. They found them deep inside a ravine, about 246 feet away from the cedar trees, buried under 13 feet of hard packed snow. And this is where our case turns from a tragedy into a nightmare. So the first five hikers had officially died of hypothermia. Simple and sad, but natural. But the four in the ravine, they looked as if they had been in a war. Nikolai had a fractured skull. The fracture was so severe that the bone had driven into his brain. Lyudmila and Semyon had massive chest fractures. Lyudmila had multiple broken ribs on both sides. And Semyon's chest was flail, so it was completely crushed.
But those all those injuries that have come from falling in the ravine.
That's possible. But the medical examiner was baffled because, like you said, simple explanation, they could have fell into the ravine. But there were no bruises on the outsides of their body. The skin was not cut. And according to him, the force that would have been required to cause this damage would have been equal to a car crash at 50 miles an hour. So if they had
They were under 13 feet of packed snow.
Oh, hang on. Worth it calling. Hello? Hey. Oh, hi, Bobby. Oh, okay. Okay. Right. Okay. So even if it shows on there that it's wrong and I acknowledge it, it'll still be what I chose. Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. I want to acknowledge our new benefit and what I chose, the price of that and the price that was on the acknowledgement, was it the same? I'm like, what the hell? So I went and seen it, and she had just seen it on hers as well. And she had finally heard back from the benefits team, and they said that they had to go in and do something. And those emails and everything went out before they were able to get in there and acknowledge all the new packet. And so she said it should be in there updated. But the lady told her, even if it still shows what I'm paying now, and I acknowledge it, it's not, that won't be the price for insurance for next year. It'll be what I chose. So it was just a system. Okay, so if they would have fallen into the ravine, they would have had external injuries to match those internal injuries, but they didn't.
Not necessarily.
That's according to the medical examiner.
No, they ain't real smart.
That's according to the medical examiner. But I also could not find how deep the ravine was. So it could have been a short little ravine, or it could have been hundreds of feet.
Yeah, but with 13 feet of packed snow on it, those would crush bones
Right.
And all that.
Right. But if they would have fallen, they would have ended up, they would have some kind of bruise, cut or something.
No, not necessarily.
I would think anyway.
If they landed in snow. I
that's
mean,
true. They could have fallen and landed on top of snow already in the ravine. That's true. I didn't think about that. This whole thing is a...
What the hell?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. So this whole thing was as if they had been squeezed by a giant pressure bike. Because, I mean, honestly, that's how it seems. Like, she had ribs broken on both sides.
Okay. Let's see.
What are you Googling?
No, now I get my phone.
Go to the Google. The Google.
How much? Now I don't want 520 pounds to over 27,000.
Oh, yeah. It's heavy.
Pounds per square foot.
Yeah. My only thing is that her ribs were crushed like this.
Which could have been from rolling.
So it looked, from my view, as if, you know, you grab somebody by the ribs. That's how her ribs were broken. Which there are other explanations why or how that could have happened. It's just odd that that's what her injury was. As
yeah.
if someone grabbed her by her ribs and squeezed. And then his skull was essentially
crushed
so hard that his bone was driven into his brain. Now, that could have been from all the snow on top of it. Because if his skull was already fractured, it's easy to break, completely crush it from there.
You're right.
Because it's already fragile. Then you look at their chest being completely crushed.
And that could have been that could be from the weight of the snow.
Yeah, because your chest bone is not, I mean, it's hard, but it's easy. It's easy to break.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's
crazy.
Right. There's so many different explanations, but nobody knows. So, this lack of the external injury has fueled that snow pillar or reverse fall myth. Like you said, suggesting that the hikers may have fallen backwards onto a sharp, unseen ice or snow pillar, which inflicted the powerful blunt trauma internally before snapping off. I still feel like there would be some kind of external from the fall. But I'm not a doctor. What do I know? So then there's also the strange detail about Nikolai.
Have you ever fallen in the snow?
Yeah.
Okay. You don't always get hurt.
Well, no, but like I said, we also don't know how far of a drop it was either.
Right.
So that doesn't really help because I couldn't find exactly how far of a drop. So the strange detail about Nikolai here is that he was wearing two watches on his left wrist. One.
That's weird.
Right. One of the watches showed the time of 8:14, while the other showed the time of 8:39. So was this an obsession of time that he had, or was he?
Wasn't he the smart guy?
They're all smart.
I mean, the real smart guy.
No, that's Igor.
Okay. Never mind.
So was he just obsessed with time, or were they trying to mark the exact moment of their death for whoever had found them? Because they were found together. So did she die before he did, and so he marked it on his watch?
I'm Cheetah.
And then did his watch just die, or did he know he was about to die and stop the watch just before?
Those are that's very good.
Right.
And that would make a lot of sense.
It would. Then the detail that everyone remembers most, the detail that keeps everyone up at night, Ludmila was missing her tongue. She was also missing his eyes, and Semyon was missing his eyes as well. Alexander was also reported to be missing his eyebrows.
That's freaky.
A simple fall in the snow
will not do that.
Will not do that.
I could see falling and biting your tongue.
Right.
But not. No. That don't make sense.
Yeah. In addition to these missing facial features, an autopsy note on Semyon detailed patches of dark, hardened skin and possible blistering on the soles of his feet, a unique injury that some attribute to standing on extremely hot ground or being hit by a thermal pulse.
I don't know.
Right? Now, we have to be the voice of reason here, okay? Laying in a wet ravine for 3 months, exposed to running water and small scavengers, decomposition obviously happens. Slower, but it happens. It is gruesome, but it is natural. But in 1959, to the parents and the searchers, it looked like torpor. And it very well could have been. But it could have also been a natural decomposition process.
More than likely.
But here is where the final pieces of the folklore take root. While natural decomposition is the likely culprit, the condition of the face is so bizarre that it inspired this frozen waterfall or icy river flow myth. So this one proposes that I know I said her name.
You know what? Except with the eyes missing in the tongue, that could have been scavengers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't think of that till right now. That could have been scavengers.
Yeah.
So.
It's possible.
Burnt.
But then again, maybe the Yeti did it.
I'm just saying.
I know. So this proposes that Laudmila fell face first into the stream hollow, and that the flowing water and tiny aquatic scavengers, like voles or shrews, that thrive in the cold, quickly consumed that exposed soft tissue of the eyes and tongue.
Yeah, I just said that.
Right. So the disappearance of the soft tissues in the eyebrows has been cited as the Wolverine attack folklore.
Okay.
So this suggests that a highly aggressive, non-hibernating animal like a wolverine was drawn to the bodies, causing the localized, devastating damage as an act of scavenging.
That could be too.
I thought that one was fun. Now, finally, regarding Laudmila's massive injuries. An analysis noted that two of her ribs were entirely missing from her body. Not just fractured, missing. A bizarre anomaly used to support the most extreme versions of the ritualistic murder or torture theories. This baffling extent of these internal injuries combined with the other non-fatal traumas leads dedicated researchers to point out that the original report filed by the medical examiner contained gross medical errors and conflicting terminology, suggesting that the official documentation was either hastily compiled or intentionally altered by state authorities to create ambiguous, confusing findings.
That wins.
Right. But the most heartbreaking detail of the ravine bodies is the clothes. So the bodies in the ravine were wearing clothes that belonged to the bodies at the cedar tree.
Okay.
So Simeon was wearing Xenia's faux fur coat and hat. Xena had wrapped her foot in Krivonishchenko's wool trousers. This tells us a terrible story. So the four in the ravine survived the longest. They saw their friends die at the cedar tree, and in a desperate bid to survive, they took the clothes off the dead bodies to try and save one.
Okay, now I get that.
That makes sense. Eight first.
And depending how long they laid there, when they flipped them over to take, then that makes what it explains why they were flipped over, they flipped them over to take the clothes off.
If that's what happened, yes. That's just the theory.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying it makes
sense. Okay, so the saddest fact of all, the day the incident most likely occurred, February 2nd, was Simeon's 38th birthday. So he died on the day that he was born.
Oh.
So the bodies were found, the horror was documented, and we are left with the central question. What happened? The Soviet government closed the case file, stamped it confidential, and told the families they died of a compelling natural cause. Why are you closing the file and marking it confidential?
Because they have to sign.
And then they did something even stranger. They closed off the entire area for 3 years. No hikers, no expeditions. So if it was just an avalanche, why are you banning people for 3 years and marking these files confidential?
Because something happened up there that they don't want everybody to know about.
Exactly. And if you want a reason to distrust the government, just look at the paperwork. The official criminal case file was opened on February 6th of 1959. But the tent wasn't found until February 26th. So why was the file opened 20 days before the tent was found? How did the prosecutor know to open a death investigation for these students 2 weeks before anyone knew they were missing or dead? It suggests the authorities knew something had happened on that mountain long before the search party was ever sent out. That's what they get back. See? So this secrecy fueled the wildest rumors and theories that are out there. Now, at the funerals, family members noted that the skin of the hikers was a deep brick red or orange color. Some said they looked like, quote, Africans. I hate that, but...
Hey, listen, they could have used other words.
I know. Now, pathology tells us this is likely mummification from the wind and sun at that time.
And that could be true.
Right.
That could be true. That will darken your skin and make it look a different color.
Right. But it has fueled the human experiment myth because you pair that with the foam and all of that. This theory says the hikers were exposed to a secret chemical or radiological agent that caused the skin discoloration and the radiation contamination, because remember, there were small traces of radiation found on a couple of them.
Yeah.
The crushing injuries without external marks are attributed to a controlled pressurized blast or a directed energy weapon used during a top secret Soviet. This theory also combines with the blinding flash or photochemical theory, which suggests the initial panic was caused by an intense light burst, possibly a weapon, that caused immediate severe damage to the eyes of the exposed victim, forcing them to flee blinded and in agony. Then there's also the matter of the missing notebook. So one of the hikers, Alexander, famously kept a detailed diary. He wrote in it every single day. But that notebook has never been found. Not in the tent, not around it, and not with him. So did this notebook contain the truth? Did the KGB take it? We will never know. And to deepen the mystery of documentation in the official case document, there are transcripts of the fourth diary belonging to Yuri Frifo Nishchenko. But the physical diary itself was never found or returned to his family, fueling the cover-up narrative that sensitive information was purged from those files. And then there was the radiation. Investigators tested the clothes for radiation. Why? Why? What's the point of that? Why do you need... That's not a normal test that you run.
No. But this is also Russia in the late 50s.
Right. So maybe it was normal then.
The Cold War with Cuba was starting.
So maybe it was just normal for that.
Yeah.
They had found radioactive contamination on the clothes of Simeon and Zina. Now, this is where the KGB and military theory comes in. So this theory is fueled by reports of glowing orange orbs seen in the sky by other hikers 31 miles away on that exact same night. This leads us into the final piece of key folklore, the fireballs and UFO lore.
Oh, geez.
So this built upon credible independent reports from other hiking groups seeing, like I said, bright, silent, orange spheres moving across the sky in the direction of the Dyatlov group location. The government's efforts to suppress these sightings is what created the modern myth that the hikers were killed by a secret weapon, a radiation pulse, or an extraterrestrial energy source that manifested as a glowing orb. With that, it appears that there may have been a little bit of evidence to support the alien theory.
Oh, brother.
The film Inside Simeon's Camera shows a flash of light or severe overexposure that supports that idea, that that was the last thing that Typhus had documented before the incident happened. And it was cited to be an artificial light source. So it was not a flashlight or a lantern, anything like that. She's rolled her eyes at me. She's rolled her eyes at me and shook her head. So to ground this theory in Soviet reality, many researchers connect the Oris to the R-7, the Yorka missile test. The R-7 was the world's first intercontinental ballistic missile, and its test range frequently caused light phenomena in the Urals region due to the booster rockets or vehicle debris re-entering the atmosphere. So this turns the UFO narrative into a potential highly secret military act.
And that could have been too.
Which would be why the file would be confidential.
Yes.
Why they knew about needing an investigation before the bodies were found. Just a giant it's just a giant government cover-up. So the lead investigator, Lev Ivanov, actually admitted years later in 1990 that he was pressured by the Communist Party to remove all references to these flying orbs from the case file.
Called Whiteout.
Okay, and then we all remember Semyon, right?
I'm sorry, it's like
a... Oh, you're good. He was the older veteran with the tattoos who had joined at the last minute.
Right.
There is a persistent theory called the controlled delivery. This theory goes that Semyon was actually a KGB agent and that his mission was to hike the mountain and meet a group of foreign spies who were half Americans to hand over radioactive samples as a bait operation.
Now, back then, that wouldn't surprise.
This would explain why he was wearing a camera around his neck that was never found. And it explains the radiation on his clothes.
Yeah.
The theory suggests that the deal went wrong. The spies realized that it was a setup, forced the hikers out of the tent, and executed them using professional hand-to-hand combat techniques that leave no external marks, exactly like the crushed test found in the ravine.
Hey, anything pop.
The mystery of Semyon ran so deep that in 2018, Russian journalists actually exhumed his body to run DNA tests.
Yep.
They wanted to prove that the man in the grave wasn't Semyon, but a generic body used to cover up a spy operation. Now, what were the DNA results? It was Semyon.
I can say it was probably him.
Yep. But the mystery didn't end with that. When they looked at the official Majestic graveyard records, Semyon was not listed. The grave was there, but legally, he did not exist. So in the graveyard records, it showed that plot was there, but did not show that he was in.
Why are they hiding his body?
I don't know. And the war medals that were found on the skeleton, the serial numbers did not match the ones in his military file. Because, as you know, since we've had many members of our family in the military, anytime you're given a medal, it has a serial number on it.
Yeah, that's because if you're over in war and you can use it to identify your body.
Right. Well, he was buried with...
Well, back then they did. Now they use DNA.
Right.
But back then they didn't have the DNA like we do today.
And that was the purpose of the serial number there. That was the purpose of the dog tag.
Right.
That's why you get two of them, because you're supposed to wear one around your neck and the other one's supposed to go on your boot. That way, if something happens and they only find a foot, they know whose foot it is.
Well, I got dad's a dog tag, so.
Right.
Here somewhere.
Yes. His body, the body in the grave, was buried with his medals. But the medals he was buried with didn't match the medals that were listed in his file.
Well, why didn't they just run the serial number?
Well, they did, and that's how they figured out that they weren't his. I couldn't find who they actually belonged to, and I don't feel like that's really neither here nor there when it comes to the end of, like, this part of it.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, why was he buried with someone else's medals?
Maybe they couldn't find his.
Yeah, but why give him somebody else's? That's weird.
Maybe the other guy was court-martialed.
I don't know.
And they just forgot to change the serial numbers.
I don't know. It's weird. This is a very weird thing. So, even in death, as we can see, Semyon still refuses to give up his secret and who he truly was. But,
blame him?
Right. But the verdict on the spy theory is unlikely, though. There was no shrapnel found, no blast cart, no blast freighter. The footprints in the snow were theirs alone. The radiation likely came from the fact that some of the students worked in nuclear facilities, which were common in the Urals.
Well, yeah.
But then we have the infrasound theory, also known as the panic theory. This involves a phenomenon called Kahraman vortex streak. So basically, when the wind hits the dome shape of the mountain at a specific angle, it creates a low frequency hum. And it's a sound that you can't hear, but you can feel it. So this infrasound can cause irrational terror, nausea, and dread in humans. So this theory goes that they felt a presence, panicked, and cut the tent. This explains why they had left calmly, but completely undressed. They were driven by a sound-induced irrational fear, but not a visible threat. And then finally, we have the most modern, and most likely the correct version. It's called the slab avalanche theory, aka the Russian tsunami.
Yeah. Now that explains the crushed chest.
Mm-hmm.
And the ribs, because she could have gotten rolled over by
yep.
the.
By... Why they would have cut the tent from the inside. Because you hear an avalanche.
Oh, shoot.
Before
yeah.
it hits you, you hear it.
It ain't like an earthquake.
You hear the cracking of the snow and the breaking of the ice. You hear it.
You know, you about to get whooshed.
So that would explain why they cut the tent from the inside.
And why they ran to the forest line.
Why they ran without clothes.
So they were just trying to get the heck out of Dodge.
Right. It would explain a lot.
Yeah, it would. Explain, and the way, and, you know, just watching avalanches on TV and stuff, they don't go straight down. Boy, they kind of spread out.
Yeah.
Which explains why those four were in their ravine with all that snow on top of
them. Mm-hmm. Because they could have got caught in it.
Right.
But what it doesn't explain is why the other ones were facing up the mountain as if they were going up instead of down. It does not explain that.
It could have flipped them around.
It also does not explain the fire at the tree. Why branches were broken 15 feet up.
Depends on how high that avalanche was.
But they also had skin on the tree and pieces of tree on it.
Trying to climb the trees to get away from the avalanche.
That's true, too. I didn't think about that.
It is the way you
But what about
grandma.
The fire? Why are you lighting a fire if you're trying to run from an avalanche?
Maybe after the avalanche, they decided to light a fire to hopefully... A plane would see it or to keep warm.
Maybe. I mean, the avalanche makes more sense, but there's still a lot of questions that surround
it. Oh, yeah. It's just one another theory.
Right. So for 60 years, experts said that the slope wasn't steep enough for an avalanche, though.
It doesn't have to be steep enough.
But in 2021, a massive breakthrough had happened. Scientists Johan Gomi and Alexander Persrin actually
and it's probably pronounced Johan.
It's with a G.
Oh, never mind.
Yeah. Hey, you could be right. I could be wrong. Could be, but I don't know. We both could be wrong. We don't speak
that. That wouldn't be the first time.
I'm trying. I'm sorry. They had actually used the snow animation code from the Disney movie Frozen to simulate the snow physics on that mountain. And here's what they found. It wasn't a giant roaring avalanche that buried the village. It was a slab. So when the group cut into the snow to pitch their tent, they destabilized the heavy block of snow that was right above them. Then sometime in the night, that block, which is heavy, as heavy as concrete, snapped loose. And it slid just a few feet. But it landed directly on the tent while they slept. This would explain the crush test, because the weight of the snow block pressed them into the hard ground, which would break their ribs without cutting their skin. It also explains the cut in the tent. The exit was blocked by the snow, and they had to cut their way out. So the slap theory explains the injuries. It explains the escape, but it doesn't explain the heroism. Because once they were out in the cold, injured and freezing, they didn't scatter. The healthy ones carried the injured ones. They gave their clothes to the dying. They fought for every second of life.
That makes more sense than any of them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Diet Lost Path remains the ultimate winter mystery. It reminds us that we can have the best gear, the best training, and the best of friends, but the mountain always has the final say. All right. Love you, bye.
Just spend money.
Yeah. And that's the Diet Lost Path.
That was creepy. That was creepy.
Yep. So
creepy. It's mind-boggling.
Right. And that's what I told you. That's why I was excited to tell you this one. I knew it was going to blow your mind.
Because there's so many theories out there.
Yep. And to a certain point, they all make sense.
But then there's something else that doesn't
right.
fit.
They all make sense. But then there's those little things where it's like, okay, but that doesn't fit here.
That's crazy.
Yep.
That just absolutely.
So nobody knows what happened. And this will probably be one of those that we never will.
It won't be in my lifetime, that's for sure.
Why would the government stamp the files confidential?
Because the Russian government did that a lot.
Did they?
Yes.
If it was an avalanche, it was an avalanche. It was a natural accident. Why make it confidential? That makes no sense.
But I'm just saying,
right.
Back then, you know, we'd just come off not long after World War II.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe
we were also in the depths of Vietnam.
Oh, were we?
Yes.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I guess we were, huh? I wonder if Grandpa was overseas when that happened.
Yes.
During that time, he was?
Yes. He was in the Navy from 52 to 55.
Well, I meant like actually overseas, like
yeah,
deployed.
His ship was, he was a boiler deck. Come on now.
He's still deployed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Hey, you know what? They wouldn't have been able to get there if it wasn't for Grandpa, okay?
He wasn't the only boiler.
I'm just saying, men like him are why this ship got there in the first place. To be honest, I wouldn't want to do what he did. Fuck that.
What he did.
No. Shoveling coal in them big ass fucking boilers all day, 24/7. Fuck you. You know it was hot as hell down there.
Oh yeah.
And it probably stunk.
Oh, I bet. All the men smell.
Oh, I know. All them gross, nasty, sweaty military men. Ooh.
not to offend any of our military people.
Hygiene back then was not what it is today.
Well, it was for daddy.
And that's what I mean. It's just because, you know, hygiene was different than it is today. Ships were much different.
Yeah, they didn't have ventilation like they do now.
Right, exactly. And that's what I mean. You had just all the...
Yeah.
All the gross nastiness. Ugh. Then you have the smell of the coal burning, too.
Or whatever it is they use.
I'm pretty sure they were still using coal. But...
I don't know, honey. I wasn't born until the year after that this happened.
Right.
So
gross. Yeah, he may not have been on the front lines, but let me tell you. He's stronger than I would have rather been on them front lines than be inside that boiler room.
Well, that's where they put daddy.
And the way that's and not only that, that's, in my opinion, that's the most dangerous part. Because if something happens, that's the first part of the ship to go. Because you're in the bottom.
I have no idea.
Yeah, those boiler rooms were in the bottom of the ship. So
shout out to our Navy, our military veterans.
So if there was to be like a not a falcon, a, I know what I'm trying to say. My brain's not wanting to.
Missile. Torpedo.
Yeah. There we go. Torpedo. There we go. I knew what I was talking about. I just couldn't, it didn't want to come out. Then the bottom of the ship is the first to go.
Well, usually the front.
Yeah, see, I'm not sure if the boilers in the front.
I don't know. I have no clue.
But either way, the bottom of the ship is the first to go. Yeah, no, I'm good. No, thank you. But maybe that's why they...
Besides that, me being claustrophobic, there's no way I could be down there.
I know, anymore. I need fresh air. I know people say fresh air is for dead people, but I need fresh air, man.
I never heard that.
Oh, yeah. That's why I don't sleep with my windows open. You never know.
I love sleeping with my window
open. I don't sleep with my windows open. Nope. How the hell do you think the Night Stalker got in? Because people left their windows unlocked and left them open. Nope. Okay, so guys, let us know what you think. Do you accept the slab avalanche theory? Do you think it was Orange Aura, so the alien theory?
It was the abominable snowman.
Do you think it was the Bumble? What do you think?
It was penguins.
And they don't have penguins though there, do they?
Yes.
I don't know.
I don't know either, honey. I just said because you're blanket.
You said yes, all confident, like they actually do, and you don't have a fucking clue. Confidence is 9 cents of it, I guess.
That's right.
All right, so let us know what you guys think. Which theory do you think? Or do you have your own theory? Or have you heard one that I did not mention? You can send us those emails or reach out on our socials with any of that, along with anything else. And that's all we have for this week. So next week is Christmas. From this episode. With Christmas. So our next one is a Christmas one.
Don't ruin Christmas.
Yep, I told you I wasn't going to, but this might ruin it.
Don't ruin Christmas.
So our next one is a Christmas Eve. And this year marks the 80th year for this unsolved mysterious fire. And 4 missing children that have never been found.
Oh, man, Missy. I ain't doing it. You can do it for Mandy.
No one knows what happened to them.
I don't like it when you involve babies.
Because there's no evidence. We don't know. So, come back next week for that one. We'll close out Christmas week with a mystery.
Hey, y'all.
Yep.
She does. Let's see what she does to me.
All right. So we hope you keep listening. Stay warm. And if you hear the wind howling tonight, maybe double check your lock. And make sure you remember to
watch out for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.